this is not worthy of my attention. And looking at where this controversy arose and what's the basis for it, a suggestion I've been making is that this is not so much a doctrinal issue, an issue of heresy, but rather an issue that pertains to some deep-seated fears. And that as we're going to be going through the Bible from Genesis 1 through to Revelation, picking up these scientific texts and misconceptions, in each case we're going to be able to understand some of the emotions that are driving this within the Christian community. It is interesting that all of these attacks against the Bible's scientific accuracy do not come from the atheists, they come from Christians. They all start off in the church. The church is where these things develop, and then they get outside into secular society, and they develop into excuses for failing to really give serious consideration to the Bible as a message that's coming from God himself. And particularly an excuse for those that are persuaded that God exists, but not that God is communicating to us or through is trying to relate to us in any personal fashion. This is where the problem lies. Well, one of the things that really encourages me about this class, one of the reasons why I enjoy teaching this class, is how much I learn from the class, particularly in the discussions that take place. Not so much an interaction here, but how numbers of you come up and talk to me afterwards and say things to me that really help me and pick a question, right? Okay. Well, one of the comments that came about last week, because you know, we were looking at this issue of carnivorous activity and how, you know, if God created a universe and a planet Earth that was declared to be very good, how could there be carnivorous activity in it? And, you know, how there are certain fears that were driving that. And they said, but have you really identified another emotion that might be there, one of anger? And incidentally, we're not trying to pick on the young earth creationists. I just see this as an excellent example to help us deal with issues that are bound to come up in the future. One of the things that concerns me in reading church history is the church consistently deals with problems like this one. They put it aside, and it's like they pretend that problems like this will never arise again. And as I've been trying to emphasize in this class over and over again, this is an issue that's dividing the church and is ruining the credibility of Christians in secular society, but it will pass. This issue will pass, and it may pass very quickly. But we can guarantee that it will be replaced. And one of the problems you see in church history is that every time one of these issues gets dealt with by the church, it's like they get out their handkerchief and they say, boy, isn't it great that that one's behind us? We never have to worry about this kind of thing again. And they get into, they kind of relax and breathe a sigh of relief, and then they get blindsided by another issue. And the problem is the tools that they developed for dealing with the controversy kind of get lost and forgotten, and they got to reinvent the wheel. And this is one of the frustrating things about reading church history. You see the church constantly reinventing the wheel. And so what we're trying to do in this class is let's look at this issue not with a narrow focus, but a broader focus, realizing other issues like this will come. They're bound to come. And if we can somehow develop some methodology, some tools, maybe some psychoanalysis here into the psyche that drives these things, and let's understand where they're coming from originally. There was a fall that took place before the fall of Adam and Eve, and that right away explains why these issues arise in the church. I mean, from Satan's perspective, where's the best place to get things really messed up? Not out in secular society, but in the church itself. And so it really shouldn't shock us that all these issues, controversies that split the church and ruin our credibility start in the church. It's always in the church. But I think what I'm suggesting would be appropriate as we go through these issues, not with the idea of how we can deal with this and put this behind us and get on with other things that are more enjoyable to do, but realize God is trying to equip us to deal with issues like this that are bound to come. In fact, I've been suggesting that God himself is responsible for blessing us with these kinds of problems. He blesses us with problems. That's one thing that I appreciate about reading the Psalms of King David. David could recognized that, you know, the problems he was facing in his life, I mean, his life was threatened many times, he saw them as blessings of God. And he knew God was blessing him through the struggles, the trials, even the threats upon his life. He saw that as God's hand. And indeed, God worked through it and equipped David to deal with problems like that that were coming in the future. He was being prepared to become the king in all those years he was wandering in the wilderness there. Well, one of the insights that was shared with me last week after class is that, we're identifying some really great fears that are behind this so-called doctrinal split here. But there might be some anger as well. And the suggestion is we need to put this in the context of the Scopes trial. And you look back to the Scopes trial, and that's really where this creation-evolution fight really got some focus in American history. I mean, it was going on in Britain before, but that's kind of like when America woke up to this issue, at least within the church, of a creation versus evolution. And the Scopes trial focused on that. And Christians saw that as a case where they lost, and they lost in a very humiliating fashion. And whenever there's humiliation to that degree, it's kind of ironic because really the teacher there was convicted. So on paper, the Christian cause was a victory. But in fact, it was interpreted by society at large and the church at large as well as a crushing defeat. What was really driving that? We have this champion of the Christian fundamentalist faith, William Jennings Bryan, ran three times for president, and as a lawyer, saw this as a great opportunity to rescue his sagging reputation. And so he jumped in there as a champion of Christian fundamentalism. And one of the things that angered the fundamentalists is that this gentleman, under the close cross-examination of Clarence Darrow, changed his theological position. And, you know, what was being shared with me last week was maybe a fear we need to look at is a fear that we're going to have to change our way of looking at the Bible. We have to change our way of examining our systematic theological system, and there's a lot of people that get very uncomfortable with the idea that they might have to make adjustments in their interpretations of what God is trying to reveal to us through the Bible. And I think you know the story. We have William Jennings Bryan coming to the court case, and then Clyde Darrow puts him on the stand and begins to question him about the Bible. And one of the things that becomes clear is that Clyde Darrow, the atheist lawyer, was more astute about certain passages of the Bible than this champion of the fundamentalist Christian faith. So that was one point of embarrassment. The other point of embarrassment is under this cross-examination, Clyde Darrow was able to force a change in the theological interpretation of William Jennings Bryan on these days of creation. So on the stand, this physician was forced out of him. And that was viewed as kind of, you know, this great champion of the Christian faith caved in under the pressure of the atheists, and they were expecting William Jennings Bryan to really upstage Darrow the atheist in terms of Bible knowledge. It was the other way around. And the expectation was that Clyde Darrow would be the one, Clarence Darrow would be the one that would repent of his evil atheistic ways. And what happened? It worked out the other way, that the Christian had to admit that his interpretation wasn't quite on target and made a change, made an adjustment. Very appropriate. I mean, if these two men were kind of talking in private, I think it might have been different. But the fact that it was in front of literally the entire American audience, the world audience, everybody taking notes, putting it in the newspapers, it made it difficult. And if you read the newspapers of the following months, it was definitely interpreted as a tremendous humiliation of William Jennings Bryan in particular. In fact, he died just a few weeks later as a result of what was extreme emotional stress. And then the Christian community saw this as definitely a humiliating defeat for their cause. And it's like the fundamentalist Christians of that time up to this day have really not forgiven. William Jennings Bryan. They've had a difficult time forgiving the atheists and the scientists that forced this change upon their champion. And so this may be really the birth of this anti-scientific, anti-intellectual stance that has arisen within the Christian church. Certainly in the 10-20 years that followed the Scopes trial, that was a definite shift that we could see within the Christian community, especially the fundamentalist community. And something else has been lost. You know, I have the books, The Fundamentals of the Christian Faith, that came out of the conference that began in 1919, where the fundamentalist movement was launched. And if you read those books, the leaders were preaching old earth creationism. And but over the years, from 1919 up to about the mid-1920s, was when you have the birth within the Seventh-day Adventist Church of flood geology, and with it this young earth creationism, and this began to spread throughout the community, and the presumption was that the fundamentalist position was young earth and global flood. But if you read the historical roots of the first conferences of the fundamentalists, it was quite the other way around. And so here's William Jennings Bryan stepping into this situation, and some interpreters have said, you know, he was always an old earth creationist, and so he didn't really change his position, but he was a politician, all right, and he could read the winds of change within the fundamentalist Christian community, and what he was really trying to do is run the court case in such a way that his real beliefs wouldn't be exposed. But Darrell, the clever lawyer that he was able to dig this out of him under oath, and that resulted in William Jennings Bryan no longer being viewed as a champion of the Christian faith, and that's really the humiliation he felt. So there's a couple of different takes you can put on this. But nevertheless, it's indicating that there was an anger there at what was viewed as a great defeat, an anger at the champion, an anger at scientists for getting them into this spot, and these atheist lawyers have been getting them into this spot, and maybe an anger at themselves for even letting this happen. I mean, maybe it would have been better if they just ignored what had been going on in Tennessee, and you'll play their cards a little bit differently. So there's a lot of anger going on there, and that may be clouding the issues. But also, there's a fear that if we really give too much attention to what's happening in the frontiers of science, it's going to force us to change our interpretations, our theology. And that's one of the things I've noticed in looking at the young earth creationist literature, is you really do see there a strong desire to have a system of theology that's so well worked out, you'll never have to change it. And that really explains their idea. You know, every time we discover something new, it must be interpreted in what we already understand to be the truth. And so there's a forcing of new information into the systematic theology they've already adopted, rather than allowing new information to possibly cause them to adjust their systematic theology. So that fear, I think, is there. It's there in a very strong way. Yes. Well, I want to get into that, because there's no question that the fear of evolution is one of the biggest things driving this controversy. And, you know, we read this little piece about carnivorous activity, and it's going to fit into what I'm going to be sharing today about, you know, let's try to examine this fear of evolution and deal with that. If we deal with the fear, we might be able to make some progress. You know, I've had some experience in this through Reasons to Believe. Incidentally, when we launched Reasons to Believe, we were kind of thinking, maybe we can just ignore this one and just push on with the evidences. And we kind of got clobbered, blindsided in many respects. I certainly didn't anticipate that we would draw the resistance that we did in launching this organization. And it's certainly gotten much more intense as the years have gone by. So it's something that we've been naive about. I'll just admit that. I've been very naive about this situation, but I've learned a lot in the process about what works and what doesn't work. And that's kind of what I'm doing here in this class, is just trying to show you, share with you some of the mistakes I've made about you know, trying to go ahead with things that I thought must work, and it didn't work. And I think one of the ways I could generalize this is I began this thinking, if I can just simply lay out the hard evidences, biblical and scientific, and the logic behind that, that will do it. And I can tell you right now, that was a mistake. Not that that shouldn't be done, but that shouldn't be the primary means of trying to deal with this issue. Because that's not really where it lies. It's not the fact that the evidences are not understood. It's the fact that there are fears there, there's anger there, that's really not being dealt with. And so what I'm suggesting is that you might get a little bit further presenting the evidences and demonstrating the logic, the rationality of your arguments. If you put it in the context, well, you know, let's identify the fears and the anger that's driving this. And if we can deal with that at the same time we're presenting the evidences, we might make a lot more progress. Okay, before I launch into it, Tony had a comment? No? Okay. He did, okay.
How do you see them reconciling their theories regarding what Scripture is saying about the Word of God and God Himself not changing, not being able to change?
Yeah, God can't change, His Word doesn't change, but our interpretation of it could change. And the problem is, and you know, this isn't just the young earth creationists. There are many components within Christian teaching where people examine the Bible, they read it, and are convinced that their interpretation is identical to the words themselves and what God was intending. Hey, you're human. You could be misreading the text. You could be misinterpreting the text. How do you find out where the misinterpretations lie? Well, you're never going to find out where the misinterpretations lie unless you first admit that there's a possibility that what you're reading from the text may be an interpretation, that it might be subject to change. It's not that God is fallible, but we are fallible. And as long as we can appreciate that, then it opens up the possibility that we can discuss these things without the emotions. You know, if all of us have the possibility of being wrong, let's get together and discuss this. We have different perspectives, we have different data to bring to play, and maybe we'll learn something. But if you go into the discussion with the impression that I've got nothing to learn, I've got it all figured out, and I'm really here to teach you what I already know to be true, now, how far are you going to get with that kind of approach? I mean, you can bring people together to discuss things, but if that's the attitude that people are bringing to the conference table, chances are you're not going to get very far. And incidentally, this doesn't just happen on Christian doctrine. It happens in life, right? You bring the managers of the company together with the union leaders, and you run into the same kinds of things. So politics, etc. I mean, it's we're human. That's what happens. But the problem is when you get into the church, people have this idea, well, that happens outside the church. Inside the church, we're rational, well-reasoned, logical, okay? And that's not true. So, and God has His ways of exposing it. Maybe inside the church is where it's best exposed. Kathy?
I'm wondering if maybe we haven't been short-sighted in our real grasp of what the New Testament writings were. The apostles, the writers of those books, devoted a great deal of time and attention to addressing and taking care of the various points of the Gnostic heresy, because the Gnostic heresy was the first and biggest threat to the spread of the gospel and the understanding of the gospel. And I'm kind of getting this picture as you talk, that what's happened through the centuries is various manifestations of the Gnostic heresy have arisen through the centuries, that it's always going to be a sort of a force that works. We always want to say that the problem is something about knowing or whatever. And I'm thinking maybe that's the problem. We forget the roots. We forget that these things have already been addressed for us. The fundamental issues have been addressed for us. And the writers have exposed our tendencies, the direction in which we often go to get off track. And maybe we fail to acknowledge that each of these little issues that has arisen has just been a unique example of or outgrowth of that basic heretical problem. And maybe if we were to study a little more to understand, you know, what that is and how it manifests itself, we could not be so sidetracked or get so excited about a particular problem and its uniqueness and then do that thing you were talking about and get that one solved. Great, it's taken care of. No, we will forever be having to keep an eye on our own tendency to go off base and off base in a particular way. And that's kind of what comes to me as you're talking to this thing.
Well, you're making another suggestion that I want to emphasize, and that is that in the New Testament, we're exposed to problems within the church that have their parallel in all problems that have split the church over the past 20 centuries.
We haven't always made the connection.
We haven't always made the connection, but I'm going to take off on what Kathy has said and said, you make the connection on this particular issue, and let's see as we get into other chapters of the Bible if you can make the same connections. Now, one sense, we've already done it for you, right? And before I address you, I'm just going to say that I remember a phone call I got from a young earth creationist after I published this book, who wound up publishing another book that critiqued my book. And an identical title. But his comment was, he says, you know, Dr. Ross, what offended me was not you hinting that we were unscientific or that we were unbiblical. He says, that did offend us. But what offended us most of all was your suggestion that we were Gnostics. He says, that's what really got us ticked off. And that's why we're publishing this book. He says, we're deeply offended. He says, we know you didn't make the charge directly, but it says, if you put two and two together, that's really what you're saying. Okay? And I had to admit that he had a point there, and I asked him if he was prepared to defend that charge, and he said, I'm not a scientist. And I said, well, wasn't that what the Gnostics were doing? They were saying, we don't have to pay attention to the natural realm at all. We're free to ignore it because it's not real. And what you're really saying is, look, I'm not a scientist, therefore I don't feel obligated to deal with that. But that's what the Gnostics were saying. We're not obligated to deal with physical, natural reality. And he says, well, this is probably a good time for us to stop the conversation. So we ended in a friendly point at that, but he went ahead and published his book. But what I noticed when we looked at the book, he ignored the Gnostic issue in the book. But that's what offended him most of all about my book. But likewise, I think you can make a connection, as we've done, between circumcision and this issue. But I think Kathy's right. We could go through all the controversies that split the church and see parallels there. In one sense, what the Apostle Paul was doing was giving us general tools to deal not with just specific problems of that time, but problems that the church would be continuing to face. Yes?
I don't think you should downplay the evidence. I think a lot of the anger that's connected with the Scopes trial is going to die with that generation. I was just mentioning to my husband, my father was one of that generation. He's a brilliant man, a brilliant scientific man, but could never see the old earth because he grew up with the fallout of the Scopes trial. But I think those emotions are still there, but it's going to die with that generation. And a lot of the young generation has gotten a lot more science, and we need the evidence like your book sitting there so when they get and they can say, oh yeah, here it is, here's the concrete evidence. There are so few Christians that really know science because Christians have stayed away from science for so many years. You go to a Christian school and try to major in some of the hard sciences and see how far you get compared to the liberal universities.
Now, you got an excellent point. You know, when I speak on university campuses, I do notice that there are people there who really aren't bothered by this young earth, old earth issue, mainly because they've never gone to church, they've never met or talked to Christians, they haven't been reading the newspapers, so it's not that big of an issue for them. They may have heard of it, but it doesn't bother them. And these evidences that we're talking about have value whether or not the controversy's there. And I totally agree with that, and we're really committed to do that. When I speak on university campuses, I pretend that nobody in the audience is bothered by old Earth versus young Earth. If they are, they're going to bring it up in the Q&A. And so I don't make it part of my content at all. It's not even in there. Because I think it's more important that we present the positive evidences for the Christian faith rather than dealing with the negative problems. And if you present those positive evidences in a sufficiently complete and persuasive manner, then all the negative stuff's bound to come up. And, yeah, I can guarantee it will come up. It just does. And so I don't have to put it into my message. That's a natural reaction. And actually, we see a New Testament parallel to that. You know, when the Apostle Paul would go into a new town, he didn't address all these negative, controversial issues. He just let them come up. Then he dealt with them. But his message was devoid of that material. And I think, you know, God's given us a good strategy we can follow. Because remember, there will be people in the audience for whom these negative issues aren't a problem. And so, you know, why stir up stuff? I mean, what you're doing is just bringing up issues that's going to, you know, really get in the way of them receiving what's there. So that's an excellent way to go. And one of the things I've noticed, too, is that the more we focus on the evidences, the greater ease you have in dealing with these issues. I think one of the things I've seen with the volunteers in our organization that come from a young Earth perspective and have joined in with us, they said, you know, what really helped is to realize that with the old Earth perspective, they had a much stronger evidential base for the Christian faith than with the young Earth perspective. And it just made their job of evangelism a whole lot easier, and they all had a heart for evangelism. And so if you can focus on that, that really helps get them through some of these issues. But at the heart of all this, there's some very strong emotions. And even with people that are persuaded that the evidence is on our side, you have to deal with that. You know, as I mentioned last week when I was talking to these scientists from Huntsville, Alabama, who were all raised in Christian homes where the young Earth position was taught, and then they learned about science and discovered that the old Earth position was correct. The emotion they had to deal with, I mean, they were already convinced and persuaded. But what they had to deal with was this deep emotion of being cheated. You know, we invested 10, 20 years into something that we now discover isn't true. And just trying to admit to yourself that, you know, you poured all that time and energy. And what they were counseling me as they were driving me from Huntsville down to Montgomery is that you need to realize, you know, that the loss and the grief that you feel when you make that discovery says it's kind of like losing a loved one. You put all this time and energy, this is something you really cherish, there's all these people that you really love within the movement, and then to discover that there's a loss there. And so we have to give these people time to grieve. And the grieving period takes years. You know, there's one guy was describing, says after 4 years of making the break, there's still the grief there. There's still a lot of my closest friends that are in that. There's a brokenness there. It's kind of like a divorce. And, you know, that's tough. So even with people who have been fully persuaded, there's a lot of wounds and scars that have got to be dealt with. And maybe we need a little more wisdom in trying to help these people through that healing process.
I think it's natural that some of those same people then look to the next doctrine that they've been taught, which is you burn forever and ever in hell, and start to question that, because if they feel like they've been betrayed on the creation doctrine, maybe that one's wrong too. So maybe that's why you get some of this movement questioning what hell really is. Really looking at what the scripture says rather than what you've heard from.
And isn't that something new, too? I mean, just kind of what we've been emphasizing, this fear that we might have to question everything. You know, in one sense, this is something that's very healthy. It's biblically mandated that we question and doubt and deal and test. But have you been taught all your life to avoid that? Have you been taught all your life that that's not a very spiritual thing to do? You know, you must trust what you've been taught. And they'll hold to that. And, you know, don't let these things get in the way of your spiritual growth. Hold fast, exactly. I mean, we can quote all kinds of Bible verses to support our sinful response to all of this. We're good at that. That's something that takes a lot of time to get past. This new idea, well, gee, maybe I better be looking at a few other issues. Maybe I need to be questioning some of this. And maybe that also explains why these people have come out of that, have such a hunger to get together with other people and discuss these issues. You know, Kathy sometimes jokes with me, and we have these meetings with our apologists. You know, they just talk all afternoon. You can't get them to turn it off. And, you know, I lock up the Reasons to Believe building, and they're all standing there in a parking lot, and I drive away. So it happens every time. But it's like, you know, they've been starved all of their lives, and suddenly the fountain is open, and they just can't get enough to drink. And this goes on for years. And it's something we kind of joke about what happens when you get these people together. It's interesting. Yes, Ted.
I think it seems incredible that this discussion has nothing to do with salvation. Yet it seems to be more of a stumbling block than the question of whether or not Christ died and rose.
Yes. It's got nothing to do with salvation, Ted, but let me complete what I... I opened up a can of worms here, so let's deal with one of the worms. What I'm asking you to do, okay, I made that point that would really upset a couple of these people was my making the suggestion that there might be a Gnostic base to this young earth position. Why? What impressed me about the two men that wrote this book against my book is that from their perspective, they could make that connection. They made it easily. I wasn't expecting this to be something that they could easily draw. So in one sense, I was encouraged that they got so angry at this idea that the base of their theology is Gnosticism. I said, this is a good step that they've made that connection. Because I think when we phrased that chapter, we were thinking that this is going to be a very difficult logical step for them to make. It wasn't. Why not? Okay, what's the connection? I'm throwing it back to you. And why can you say that the heart of the young earth position, in one respect at least, is Gnostic theology? Okay, yeah, good. Somebody want to take a stab at defining for us what the Gnostic position is? Go ahead.
Gnostic, the material world was really unreal, or at least it was produced by a lesser god or an emanation from God. So it was really irrelevant to the eternal, real, spiritual things of God. You know, you can kind of dismiss it, either by being ascetic, living a life totally denying any physical bodily needs, or going out and flagrantly sinning, because either way it was irrelevant because it was done in the body.
Okay. What's good is that we're seeing that Gnosticism isn't just one flavor. It's not that all Gnostics are legalistic or that all Gnostics are licentious, but that the heart of this proposition that the physical world is not real. Or what I really like by what you said is that there's another version of Gnosticism. One makes the position that the physical world is not real or illusory. The other one is that the physical nature of creation is inferior to the spiritual. And therefore, what we're seeing through the physical is something that we can ignore or not put on the same standing as what's given to us in the spiritual realm. So it's a matter of degree. And one extreme form says it's not there at all. The other one says, well, it's there, but it's inferior, it's tainted, it's ruined. Therefore, we don't have to pay attention to it. Tony, I'll come back to you, Mel.
In a broader sense, Gnosticism is just one split among a number of different splits where you don't see truth as a seamless continuity.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Yeah. Truth is not a seamless continuity. In other words, there's portions of what God has revealed to us that's more true than other portions of truth he's given to us. Okay? Isn't that incredible? What that really means is there's a misunderstanding of the term truth. Remember when Jesus said, what is truth? Good question to ask. Yeah, Mel.
knowledge that's not widely disseminated, and they may, you know, look at the world at large, the scientific establishment at large, as having their realm of knowledge. They don't really know what's going on in the world like we do. There was that element of Gnosticism.
You know, that's something I never put in my book, but it's so true that that's what you see from the young earth community, is that we have a source of knowledge. And because of this, we have a superior, lock on the truth than what's coming from the scientific community. And so, and that's also something that Paul warned us about the Gnostics, is there's this superiority element going on. We are the ones that have this channel of information of truth. We have it, you don't. Because we have it, you know, it justifies their superior attitude to ignoring what other people are revealing to them and saying, well, you know, we really have what it takes. Yeah, Tony.
Once you split something off, the tendency with people as well as ideas is that they swell to madness and isolation. They no longer have any feedback and interaction with the other groups or areas of truth, and they swell and converge and really go off.
Yes, and aren't there many Gnostic cults today? It isn't just one. There are many varieties. I think Paul warned us of that in Galatians and Colossians. He wasn't just addressing one kind of Gnostic. Each book he was dealing with a different kind. Yeah.
Somewhere I got the impression that Gnosticism was a belief that we can't know the things of God. All we can do is study toward learning them. And the more you study, which is why the cult developed, they became essentially a cult of learners who were seeking and the full knowledge of God, but said, can't know full knowledge of God. So what I'm hearing here is definition of Gnosticism is different than what I...
Well, Ted, I think what you're saying is compatible with what Tony is saying in the sense that the Gnostics would apply your statement to natural revelation, but not to special revelation. In other words, we can know when we're looking at the 66 books of the Bible, but we can't know when we're looking at the record of nature. Because, you know, that's illusory, that's not trustworthy, or in the extreme form, it doesn't even exist. And therefore, in that realm, we can't know, and therefore anything that the scientists are telling us from their study of the natural realm is suspect. We really don't need to pay any attention to it. But if it's coming through these 66 books, that is spiritual, it's not physical. And therefore, we can know. Because if you say we can't know across the board, then you really don't have theism, you have agnosticism. So they're agnostic in terms of the natural revelation. They're theistic in terms of the special revelation. Okay, now, who's going to make the connection for us? I think we got this Gnosticism well defined. Now let's make the connection. Huh? The connection between the young earth doctrinal system and Gnosticism. Okay.
Well, I see the connection when liberal theologians separated spiritual truth from history and science and whatever. There's two realms of truth, and in the lower realm, science and history, there is no, at least nowhere, no need in terms of whether one is an upper story detached from some really God. The younger creations are actually on a lower story, saying there's no truth. We don't dare trust this down here, history or science. We don't really dare trust this. And they're really doing combining an upper story and lower story too. I think Francis Schaeffer is great about that.
Right.
So they're really doing the same thing in a different way. And really separating. And God, because they like archaeology that points to confirming the tradition of history of the Old Testament, for example. That's fine. Carbon dating, whatever. Used for that, but if it touches on something where it doesn't go where they want it to go, then they're
coming. Okay, and where doesn't go where they want it to go? See if we can nail that one down. Okay. It's a time component, right. And,
The cosmos itself is an illusion.
The cosmos is an illusion. Why must the cosmos be an illusion?
Because it looks old.
You know, it's even simpler than that. It's big. The universe is big. It's too big to fit into a young Earth paradigm. In fact, our galaxy is too big to fit into a young Earth paradigm. Even the center of our galaxy is too far away to fit into a young Earth paradigm. So when you see all these photographs of 100 billion other galaxies, they can't be real. They're too far away. They're too big. So that's really the issue here. And not only that, it's an issue that's not just being exposed by people like myself, but the young Earth creations themselves admit that that's the issue. And, you know, in my book, I quoted from Gary North, who said, you know, given our young Earth position, we've only got a few alternatives. The light from the stars and the galaxies is an illusion, or the stars and galaxies themselves are an illusion. One of them must be an illusion. The light is either illusory, or the stars and the galaxies are illusory. Now, in that sense, you've got the Gnostic position. What they're really saying is that the universe, in some respect, is an illusion. And Gary North is right. You know, with the young Earth position, one of them must be an illusion. It's got to be, because of the vast distances involved. And there's no way out of that. One of them must be there, yes.
What does he choose to say, that the stars are the illusion or the light?
Or Gary North doesn't make the choice. What he points out is that it's either one or the other if you take the young Earth position. And he says, you know, I support the young Earth position. And, you know, this is the situation. Now, if you read into the young Earth literature, they will opt from one side of the fence or the other. For example, the Institute for Creation Research takes the position that God sent the light on the way. So instead of the light coming from the Andromeda Galaxy, it comes from some place in outer space that's closer to us than 10,000 light years. Instead of coming to us from 2 million light years, it comes to us. So the image of the Andromeda Galaxy is being sent to us from one of the nearby spiral arms, for example, rather than where it would actually reside. That's the position they take. If you look at Ken Ham's organization, Answers in Genesis, they're making the point that the velocity of light is an illusion. Instead of traveling at 300,000 kilometers per second, if you go back sufficiently far in time, which is a few hundred years to a few thousand years, it's traveling at near infinite velocities, and therefore the stars and the galaxies are very close to us. Instead of being at extreme distances, they're very close to us. But that leads you into the fact that the sizes of the stars and the galaxies must be an illusion. I mean, you can't have these stars within a few miles of us if they're 886,000 miles across pouring out that kind of energy. So, I mean, you run into illusions there. So the velocity of light is an illusion, but the stars and the galaxies themselves might be an illusion. One other group takes the point that light takes a shortcut through space, that there's a difference between the spatial geometry and the paths that the light faces. In other words, the universe isn't geometrically flat. By the way, it's not perfectly flat, but it's so close you can't really, it's hard to really notice the difference. And so they say, you know, space is an illusion. You know, something has to be illusory in order to make the paradigm work. And it's because ultimately we recognize the system is vast. And so you're dealing with a challenge between the size of the cosmos and the age of the cosmos. And there's no way to separate the time scale from the size scale problem here. So it's an illusion. The universe itself must be an illusion. Now you have to extend that to the Earth. Because as Henry Morris has pointed out in a book he wrote a few years ago, you really can't separate the evidence for the age of the universe from the age of the Earth. The young Earth creationists recognize that themselves. So that means the Earth must be an illusion. In other words, well, I mean, you know, it's easier to see in that sense. Where do you get all the marble? Or you go up to the high Sierras and you see this talus at the bottom of a mountain and little rocks that eroded off the mountain. And you measure how fast these rocks are falling off the mountain. You make a little multiplication on your slide ruler or pocket calculator, and you realize it adds up to a whole lot more than 10,000 years that those rocks. It's like kind of dealing with Christian scientists who are the Gnostics of the flavor we run into in the book of Colossians. And you say, well, pain is not real. And you say, well, how about if I punch you in the nose? Let's do an experiment here, okay? If your Gnostic position is true, then you should have no objections to me punching you in the nose. What we're really trying to do here, see, what you're doing there is you're applying a logical argument
to an emotional issue.
And incidentally, if you offer to punch a Christian scientist in the nose, you're probably going to get him a little bit upset, okay? Yeah, you probably will. I mean, you can do these experiments yourself, and you can verify that he or she will get upset at the suggestion that you perform that kind of an experiment. And the reason why they're getting upset, you're bypassing an emotional issue, okay? You're trying to come across with logic and physical evidence when that's not the problem. So, now you can do that if you bring in, in other words, if you really address the emotional issues that are there, what they're really afraid of, you know, what are the Gnostics afraid of? Okay, what did Paul say the Gnostics were afraid of? What are they afraid of? Okay, God's not good? Yeah. It's a three-letter word I'm looking for that they're really afraid of. Sin. That's it. Okay? What is it that sins within me? My physical members. All right? So if my physical members and what my physical members are doing in the physical world is not real, sin is not real, and that's a great way to deal with my sin. And, you know, as we pointed out here, it manifests in two ways. You know, this fear of sin can cause me to lead an ascetic lifestyle where I kind of, you get into the monastery mode and I live, don't eat meat and follow all these rules and things, and that will keep me away from all this stuff. Outwardly it will. We'll deal with the sins plural, but not the sin singular. And then the other thing is say, well, since it's not real, I can do anything I want. And it's not really a problem because it's in the physical arena. So it manifests itself in two extremes, but that's really the fear. Yes, and we'll come back to you, Tammy.
Particularly in terms of the size of the universe and the age of the universe, why is that so threatening to the creation? I mean, Genesis 1:1, the beginning, God created man from the earth, and the earth fell from the
sun. Okay, what's so threatening about it? I was hoping to get to it this week. We're out of time. What's so threatening about it is evolution. They're convinced that they concede billions of years, and they're on the side of Clarence Darrow, okay? And we've now kicked God out of the whole picture. So we need to address this fear of evolution. I was going to read you this little piece. Maybe I'll do this, but get Tammy's comment. Okay, then I'll try to wrap things up. Go ahead. Okay. All right. By the way, when I was giving this list of the Gnostic solutions, you know, that maybe light is an illusion, maybe the stars and the galaxies are an illusion, maybe God sent light in the way, maybe there's a shortcut through space, Tammy here's bringing up another one. Appearance of age. But appearance of age is also Gnosticism. Okay, in this sense. The bottom line of appearance of age is God made things look old when in fact they're very young. Okay, don't be offended by this, but he made you look old. And the fact is, you're very young. Okay, you're only 5 minutes old. But you have the appearance of someone who looks like they're just slightly over 30 years of age. Okay? All right, that was a nice one. All right. One up there. Please return the favor. Okay.
Now we can talk about
people. Yeah, right. Appearance of age. Okay. But, you know, it's worse than that. The fact that you're married, the fact that you have children, the fact that you paid your taxes on April 15th, or not, I mean, all that really is an illusion, because it's possible that 5 minutes ago, God put prints on my brain to make me think that I had these experiences. Really, I was created just 5 minutes ago. And all the stuff I'm teaching you is not stuff I learned by going through years and years of education and reading. That's not where it comes from. God put it on my brain 5 minutes ago. And this memory I have of my honeymoon, it didn't really happen. God put it within my... Okay. Thank you, Tom. Forgot something there, right? But, I mean, again, that's kind of how you can deal with this, is the fact that, you know, this has got to be illogical, because, you know, all my experiences, thoughts, emotions, really didn't happen. God placed it there. But what am I really afraid of? What I'm afraid of is this. Okay, in all the years I've had where these imprints have gotten onto my brain, some of that I really don't want to deal with. I'm ashamed of it. So if I come up with an appearance of age kind of doctrine, it's a way I can safely ignore all that. And that's one way I can deal with my fears. And the fact that God allowed me to go through those experiences may cause me to question the character of God. You know, a really good God wouldn't have exposed me to that. And, you know, that's emotionally difficult for me to put that charge against God, that he was so cruel, he took me through that. And if I don't want to deal with that, if that's a fear about, you know, what I'm saying about God that I don't want to face, then I can develop a Gnostic interpretation that will allow me to kind of put that in the garbage can and leave it there. I can ignore it. So, again, you know, we can make the logical arguments, but we don't deal and say, okay, what is it in all of this that you're afraid of? What is it that you're really angry about? And then dig into that perspective. Next week, okay, we'll get into the fear of evolution, how to deal with the fear of evolution. What I'm really suggesting is this. What they say they're afraid of is the old Earth and the old universe. That's not what they're afraid of. They're afraid of evolution. And so if you try to deal with their fear of an old universe, you're on the wrong track. Deal with their fear of evolution. And if we can deal with that, the old Earth, old universe thing will take care of itself. If you misidentify the fear, you can be arguing until you're blue in the face and nothing will happen. They'll stick to their position. Try that with a Christian Scientist. If you get on the wrong issue, you can talk until you're blue in the face and nothing will happen. But once you identify the root fear, then we can make progress. And incidentally, if you make a mistake on identifying the root fear, don't worry about it. One way you know that you've made a mistake, nothing happens. Okay? Look for something else. It's okay. Father in heaven, thank you that you've given us the freedom to make mistakes, to make misinterpretations. You've allowed all of us to do that. And Father, I pray if there's one thing we can learn from all of this, is that this is our human state, that we do make mistakes, we do misinterpret. And Lord, I pray in that context, you give us a compassion for people that have, in at least one context, developed the idea that they're free of making these kinds of mistakes and misinterpretation. And maybe as we can just share some of our own experiences, some of our own struggles in going through issues like this, that we can build a bridge there and help them, help their eyes be opened to the fact that, yes, we are sinful, and we don't always have the understanding we lack, but you are there to help us. Father, thank you that you so powerfully demonstrate through your word that we are helpless to deal with our sin, our failures, our mistakes, our misinterpretations, but you have given us the law of the Spirit. You can rescue us from what our mind cannot rescue us from. And Lord, may we be more willing to come to you for the help that we need, for the humility that we need, the grace and the wisdom that we need. So bring us to that point. In Jesus' name, amen.
the creation and time?
Yes.
I thought they were still arguing against the Big Bang.
They are.
Oh, okay.
The Big Bang means a big universe.
Yeah, and then you have to deal with the distances. If you don't have a Big Bang, it could have been created with all the stuff already out there. And then a big distance wouldn't necessarily have to be for the whole day.
Well, one of the things we're putting in the next newsletter is that they've made the point that distances in astronomy are based on trigonometric parallax.
Okay.
So, all the trigonometric parallax is all within the younger time scale.
Really?
They all do. Until this year. Until this year. There's been a breakthrough that now gives us trigonometric parallaxes that go beyond the time limits permitted by the creation.
I thought that they were way beyond 20,000 years.
Oh, we are by indirect methods, because we use our trig parallaxes to establish distances to standard candles. And the standard candles allow...